Okay, 3 o'clock. Okay, Dr. Schwartz, Dr. Press Schwartz, always a pleasure to have her. Always has interesting insights, and we look forward to your share. Bakasha.
Thank you. I'm glad that we are starting in a very timely fashion because I have signed myself up to speak for Torah in Motion at 3 and in my shul at 4, and my shul and Torah in Motion are not located in the same place. Now, I did this back to back also last year, and I somehow remember it working. I'm not really sure how. Not sure how it's going to work this year, but I will end hard stop at 3:55 and then fly down the hill and get to shul. I wanted to talk today about history and memory and what it means that we are thinking about Jewish memory at a time that we are living Jewish history, the way those two things work together or don't, and particularly how we experience them on Tisha B'Av. In talking about Jewish history and Jewish memory, I am very obviously drawing from the terms laid out in the book Zohar by the great Jewish historian Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, wrote a book called Jewish History and Jewish Memory. The subtitle is Jewish History and Jewish Memory. The title is Zohar. And in Zohar, he talks about the fact that Judaism has clearly always had a consciousness of history, a consciousness of its past. That's evident from the Chumash itself, right? Zohar Yemot Olam, Binushno Dor Vador. This idea of looking back in the past is not at all a novel idea or a modern academic idea. We find it starting the Torah itself. In fact, we found it in today's Torah reading, in today's laning, right? Sha'alnal yamim harishonim asher hayu lefanecha. Inquire about the days that were before you. Hanihiyah kadavar hagadol hazeh. Was there ever anything like this great event, this great happening? Hashama am kol Hashem medaber mitoch ha'esh kasher shamata atavayechi. Did any nation hear God's voice speaking to them from within the fire and live? So inquire in history, look into the past, see if something like this had ever happened. And so yes, always this consciousness of the past, this awareness of this past and this thinking about the past, but also this illustrates to us, and this is what Yerushalmi says, that this is not about history as history. This is not about maintaining a comprehensive accounting of events or an accurate historical narrative. The purpose of this awareness or this knowledge of the past is to build a certain kind of Jewish self-understanding, of national understanding, of awareness of and commitment to a shared mission. That's what the purpose of knowing the past is. The purpose of knowing the past is not knowing the past on its own terms and for its own sake. And so he says, for example, that even in the Tanakh itself, which proceeds roughly chronologically and does give you a roughly comprehensive chronology of events, there was this king and then there was that king, and you get years and you get reigns, Yerushalmi points specifically to the king Menashe HaMelech. I'm not sure why he chose Menashe as his example. Menashe had a 55-year reign. That is a darnly long time. And the only thing the Navi tells us about Menashe's reign is, Chamishim v'chamesh shana malach b'Yerushalayim, he ruled for 55 years in Jerusalem, v'ya'as hara b'enei Hashem. And he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And then it goes on to detail all of the evil. Over the course of 55 years, surely some legislation must have been passed, some budget adopted, some public works project undertaken. There's no word of any of that in Malachim because it's not relevant, it's not important, it's not what we need to know. What we need to know is a history which is really about our national story, our self-understanding, our relationship with God. And so it isn't history the way we understand it in modern terms. Again, some attempt at a comprehensive and in some way factually accurate reckoning with all of the events as they occurred. It is rather what Yerushalmi terms memory. It is intended to give us a particular way of understanding ourselves, understanding our relationship with God, and understanding our place in the world. That's what this story is about, and that's why it's perfectly fine to sum up the 55-year reign of a king by saying in four words, in Hebrew it's four words, he did evil in the eyes of God, moving right along now. That's all we need to tell you, and then we discuss the evil. That's all we need to tell you about the reign of King Menashe. In fact, Yerushalmi points out that when we move from the period of Tanakh to the period of the Talmud, or the Mishnah, the Talmud rabbinic literature, we actually get less historical, not more. The Tanakh itself, again, is providing us with a roughly sequential listing of kings and times and periods and events that happen. It's giving us a basic chronology, even if it's not providing that chronology in the interest of an historical narrative, but rather, again, in the interest of creating some kind of national story and national memory. Once we get to the time of Chazal, Yerushalmi points out, first of all, they are not giving us any kind of consistent sequential historical narrative about themselves. They aren't telling us who they are and when they lived and the events that happened in any kind of order. And not only that, says Yerushalmi, but they like to go back and collapse the chronological ordering of the Tanakh, or create wormholes for time travel in the chronological ordering of Tanakh. And so you will see Chazal telling you that this historic, this figure in Tanakh or that figure in Tanakh actually lived hundreds of years, actually lived 1,000 years. That Og, the king of Bashan, that Moshe and the Jews fight with before they enter the land of Israel, was hanging off of the top of the ark when Noah and his, when Noah was sailing his teva through the flood and was then present. He was the one who came to tell Abraham that Lot had been captured. And so Og goes from being a particular king of a particular people situated in a particular time to being this trans-historical figure who pops up at all kinds of points in Jewish history to do all kinds of things. The rabbis did not mean by that, certainly did not mean by that, to give us any kind of historical accounting of who was where when. They certainly meant by that to give us some kind of story, some kind of understanding, teach us something, make some kind of broader point. I'm not going to rehash here, it's been rehashed many times, the problems that come from teaching children those stories as though they are meant to be renderings of historical and chronological fact. The Rambam, a long time ago, takes on those people who read Agadah, who read the story portions of the Talmud, as though they are literal historical truth, and then dismisses the rabbis as being fools or silly. The Rambam says you don't understand how to read what you're reading, and therefore you're not getting out of it what you were meant to be getting out of it. And thus things continue. Yerushalmi parses out the difference between the medieval period, the early modern period, but the basic story always is that whatever amount of interest Jews have in events of the past and in recounting those events of the past, it is not an interest in some kind of objective or academic understanding of events. It is an interest in telling a particular kind of story. And then, to be very simplistic, comes the Enlightenment and the Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah, and then comes the idea that we really should not just accept all of these stories that we've been told with all the messages they're meant to give us, but that we should apply our tools of academic scrutiny to all of these stories of our own past. Do they make sense? Can they be proven? What are the primary and secondary sources for them? And so we are no longer telling stories of national memory, telling stories that build national identity, telling stories that build some kind of corporate identity. Instead, what we are doing, in the words of Leopold von Ranke, the 19th century German historian, is to try to recount events, wie es eigentlich gewesen, the way they actually were. And that, of course, leads to a great deal, as you can imagine, of historical revision and debunking, quite a bit of which has made its way into our community. So that, for example, the stories that I was taught about Unetana Tokef as a child in a more yeshiva school system, about Rabbi Amnon and his being brought before the priest or the duke or whoever it was and being told to convert and his limbs being severed and everything else. I think, you know, every modern Orthodox 12-year-old can tell you that that's not really what happened. Rabbi Amnon didn't have... I'm not sure that we're necessarily better served by having every kid know that story didn't really happen and then by having kids think about that. We could think about that either way. And so we in the modern Orthodox community find ourselves, as we so often do, kind of caught in between. Big surprise right there. Caught between a desire to bring the tools of academic thinking and rigor, and we really should know what actually happened. And we should look at primary sources. And we shouldn't just accept myths and stories and fables. We should understand, and there is a great deal of meaning that comes from a real understanding of the Jewish past, and no knock on academic history. I'm trained as an academic historian, but academic history alone is not going to pass on deep Jewish feeling and connection and investment and involvement and peoplehood and love to our kids and our students. That's not going to be what does it. Somehow there has to be a way of nurturing a sense that there is a national story here that matters, that they are part of, and a whole lot of academic historians saying, well, not really, is not going to be the way that we exactly are going to do that. And so we're sitting here. We're sitting here at this intersection of history and memory. We think history is important. We think memory is important, trying to find our way through. And this actually comes up a lot in and around Tisha B'Av. I was a student in seminary in a post-high school gap year program in BJJ, in a Haredi women's seminary in Jerusalem. The first time that I heard that in the religious Zionist community, there were people who edited the text of the Nachem prayer that we recite on Tisha B'Av, who do not recite the text of the Nachem prayer as it was originally printed in our Sidurim. And this was presented to me by Rebbetzin Beruya David Zatzal, who was the principal of that school. And those of you who know her or know about her will not be surprised to hear that she took a very dim view of this practice of editing the text of nothing. The purpose of editing the text of nothing was to change some of this language. Ha'ir ha'avela v'ha'char. The city in mourning and destroyed and shamed and desolate. Foreign legions have swallowed her. Idol worshippers have inherited her. And they put your nation to the sword. So the first time that I heard an answer for this practice or an explanation for this practice that helped me see it as something other than just Zionist triumphalism and helped me understand it as a practice with merit was an explanation that I heard attributed to a great modern Orthodox Rosh Yeshiva. I'm not going to cite it in his name because I did not hear from him directly. I did not see it in writing. I only have it secondhand, so I can't be certain that he actually said it. But the explanation that I heard was our prayers before God should be true. We should say things that are true. If it isn't true that the city is mourning without her children, because in fact, hundreds of thousands of her children are living in the city, if the city is not in fact destroyed, if the city is not in fact desolate, then we shouldn't say in our prayers that it is. And although I personally never changed the text of an Achaim prayer that I said, and I don't think that that's standard practice, certainly in American modern Orthodox congregations to change the text of an Achaim prayer, it did make sense to me as an explanation. I understood it as an explanation. And then maybe I got older. I think the claims of truth, of history versus memory, which one is more compelling shift. And then when you're younger, you're like, just tell me what's true. I don't want to hear pretty stories. And then as you get older, you're like, how are we passing this on to the next generation? When you're older, at some point, you realize you're going to be dead. And then you wonder about, you do. And then you wonder about what's going to happen with the next generation. How are we going to pass this on? And then you say, just the facts, ma'am, is not necessarily going to be the thing that's going to help us pass it on. So now I really wonder, yes, truly, all of our tefillot must be true. On Tisha B'Av, we recite among the keynote, among the morning prayers, elegies that we recite, we recited a couple of keynote for the destruction of the Jewish communities of the Rhineland during the Crusades. And these Crusader narratives include things like stories of communities committing mass suicide rather than allow themselves to be forcibly converted to Christianity, parents sacrificing children. These are mourning prayers, mourning poems that we've been reciting as part of our Tisha B'Av observances for centuries. First Crusade was almost a millennium ago. It is well established by academic historians that these Crusader narratives are not all historically accurate. Some of them were written decades after the events they purport to describe. Some of the events they describe, by definition, had no survivors. If everybody in the community died by suicide, how are you telling me exactly how that event took place? Nobody who was there lived to tell about it. And it is very clear that the purpose of these crusade narratives that we recite in the keynote is not to give us a precise historical recounting of how this or that community died. It is telling us something that at a deep level is true about our national story. And that is that Jewish communities were massacred in the Rhineland during the Crusades by Christians who were off to free the Holy Land from the infidel and decided to dispatch the Jews along the way. That is deeply and profoundly true. And then the purpose of these stories is to connect those events to other Jewish history and other Jewish events. So we are like Avraham, who was called upon to sacrifice his son Yitzchak. We were called upon to sacrifice our children rather than have them convert to Christianity. What the precise historicity of this poem or that narrative is far less relevant to our tefillot than the fact that this is saying something true about the Jewish story. Obviously true that happened, right? Jews were massacred in the Crusades. But if the particulars and the details aren't true. And so thinking about that, about the Crusader narrative, that actually made me wonder about nothing. Really? Do we think that all of our prayers before God have to be true? Here's a simpler example. We say Akina on Tisha B'Av, and we also say in the Yom Kippur service about the murder of 10 great Torah scholars by the Roman rulers, the Asara Harugei Malchut. It is very commonplace at this point, extremely widely known. I don't have to persuade anybody that there was never an event like the one described in which the Roman ruler summons before him and says, give an accounting for why the brothers sold Yosef. And if you can't give me an accounting for why the 10 brothers sold Yosef, I will take 10 of you and kill 10 of you as an atonement for the 10 brothers. We know this because the figures who were described as the 10 Harugei Malchut, the 10 people who were killed by the government, didn't all live in the same generation. They weren't all killed at the same time. I'm not saying anything remotely novel. And so obviously taking this murder of 10 leading Torah scholars of their days, of their generations, who were murdered by Roman rule, and talking about the impact that that had on the Jewish communities of its time, and framing it in a way that connects it to Jewish memory and the Jewish story by connecting it to the stories of the 10 brothers who sold Yosef, their brother, and making this somehow an atonement and expiation for that, is not meant to be an historical argument about an emperor summoning these 10 and whatever the story was. It is meant to take events that actually happened, the murder of these men by the Roman rulers, and connect it to a story of Jewish history and Jewish memory. And nothing about the not historicity of that story makes us feel like we shouldn't say it in our prayers, because our prayers have to be accurate. We feel very comfortable saying the story in our prayers, understanding what it is meant to be accurate about and what it is not meant to be accurate about. It is meant to be accurate about a particular experience that the Jewish people had. It is not meant to be an historical recounting of how that happened. And it is meant for us, as a matter of memory, to connect that event to the broader Jewish story. I had the real privilege of participating in a few weeks ago, a gathering that happened in New York of religious Zionist educators from Israel and American educators, American modern Orthodox educators. We had been meeting together over Zoom over the course of the year, and this was the first chance we had to meet in person. This event was planned before October 7th. Whatever it was that we were supposed to be working on together over the course of the year, everything was thrown out. We had an initial meeting in September, and then everything was thrown out. We spent the year talking about all the sorts of things you would imagine we spoke about, and then we had a chance to meet for a few days at the end of July to get to know each other in person and to talk and to think together. It was really a profound experience in many, many ways. But here's something fascinating that happened. One of the educators whom I got to know, Yael Areli, who works in the school system in Modi'in, said, every year there's a new version of Nachem. Some religious Zionist rabbi in Israel comes out with edited this way and tweaked that way. And after the kidnapping from Gaza, there was one after the disengagement from Gaza in 2005. There was another changed version, another changed version. And she said, every year, another rabbi comes up with another changed version of Nachem, and the exact text of what it is that we're supposed to say. She said, this year, nobody has any problem saying the original text of Nachem. And so there's a way in which for all, it's no less true today than it was a year ago. There are hundreds of thousands of Jews residing in Jerusalem. And that Jerusalem is not, in fact, a city destroyed or a city bereft of her children. And yet there is something about the truth of that prayer as it connects us to our Jewish experience and story and memory that is profoundly true, even if it is not historically true or current eventsly true. And a community that has spent a lot of time arguing back and forth about the precise wording of that prayer has decided that, in fact, for this year, the original wording, she has been swallowed up by foreign legions. They have put her children to the sword, resonates meaningfully as a prayer to be recited on Tisha B'Av. And yet, having just said to you that I am very comfortable and certainly have become more comfortable as I've gotten older with the idea that prayers don't actually have to be true in the historical narrative sense of the truth, that prayers can very well communicate to us a sense of memory and who we are and our Jewish story without communicating to us historical understanding, I will now tell you about my own hypocrisy. I think many of our communities, probably all of our communities, recite some kina or other for the Holocaust. There are many that have been written. And in my community, we recite the kina that was written by Rav Shimon Schwab, who was the rabbi of the German Jewish community from Frankfurt in Washington Heights, New York, where I happen to live. Although I'm not part of that community, but my community recites his kina as well. And there is a line in his kina is called Tazocher Mazkirav. And there is a line in his kina talking about what the Nazis did to their Jewish victims that says, Echavchu torfehem, Livorit chalbehem, the or ish lekishut heinashim, how their tormentors turned their fat into soap and the skin of humans into decorations for women. I don't say the first half of that line. The idea of Jewish fat being rendered into soap has long since been established by historians as being a myth, as being an inaccurate story about the Holocaust. there's actually a pretty simple act of historical confusion that happened. The initials that were stamped on the bar of soap, which were the initials for the German words pure industrial fat, were misunderstood as being the initials for the German words pure Jewish fat, and thus the story got started. There are Holocaust museums that have bars of this soap on display. It's very well established historically that that did not happen. The second part of the line, I do say, by the way, there is actually historical evidence of human skin being turned into whatever kinds of objects by the Nazis. So I don't say the first half of that line. That's not a matter of Nazi apologetics. To not say that line is not to exculpate in some way or minimize or in any way the barbarity of the Nazis. There's plenty that's been historically established that the Nazis did, the same way that to say that some of the earliest stories that came out about October 7th, some turned out not to be accurate, does not in any way minimize the brutality of Hamas or the things that they did do or the things that did happen. People are not taking historical notes in extremists in these moments. And sometimes the stories that people think or hear or interpret or remember are not precisely accurately exactly what happened. It doesn't make the events any less true to say this particular piece of it is not true. And given everything that I've said to you about memory and history, I still choose not to say that line. I don't say a line about something that I know is simply not accurate, is not something that the Nazis did. This actually came up in a very interesting way in the famous trial that I think pretty much everybody's heard about, in which Holocaust denier David Irving sued Holocaust scholar Deborah Lipstadt for defaming him by calling him a Holocaust denier. And she, of course, defended that case in British court, where libel laws are much more favorable to the purported victim of libel and much less favorable to the free speech of the person who made the charge than they would have been in the United States, which is why Irving sued her in Britain. She was defended. She won the case, prevailed even in the face of unfavorable British libel law, thus establishing, first of all, that David Irving is a Holocaust denier, and second of all, that one can call him that without fear of legal sanction. Side note, I was in Atlanta last year with my children, and we were in the shul with Deborah Lipstadt Amundsen. And I saw her there in shul. She happened to be in shul. And so I did the thing that I really never do. I never bother people, but I said to my kids, that's Deborah Lipstadt. And the thing that was so amazing and awesome thing was how excited my kids were. It was like I was introducing them to the biggest celebrity they've ever met in their lives. I introduced my kids to Deborah Lipstadt. They were fangirling over her enthusiastically. And I was actually really moved to see that my kids were so, so excited by the chance to meet Deborah Lipstadt. Anyhow, in that trial, there's a great book about the trial, not the book that was written by Deborah Lipstadt herself. She wrote a book about the trial. I think was called History on Trial. There's another book called Holocaust on Trial. I hope I got the two names right, by a man named D.D. Guttenplan. It's definitely the book by Guttenplan, and I think it's called Holocaust on Trial. But one is the title of Lipstadt's book, and one is titled his book. And when she talks about the decision not to invite any survivors to testify, there is no survivor testimony in the Irving Lipstadt trial. They only had academic historians come testify. On the subject of history and memory, they weighed in 100% on the high side of history and 0% on the side of memory. It's actually in the movie that they made out of it. That is a kind of feature of the movie, is survivors confronting Lipstadt and demanding to know why they aren't going to be allowed their moment on the stand to speak their case. But here's why they didn't give them their moment on the stand to speak their case. Holocaust victims were not going through concentration camps with diaries writing down events and dates and precise recordings of what happened when. But Lipstadt knew that if one of them got on the stand and claimed that an event happened on a particular date or at a particular time or in a particular camp, and it could be proven that in fact their memory had collapsed two different events, and this didn't happen in this camp, but happened in that camp, or it didn't happen on this year, it happened in that year, that would be used by Irving and his attorneys to discredit everything that they were saying about the Holocaust. Even if we can understand perfectly well that they are expressing a profound truth and reality in the realm of memory and experience, and indeed a profound truth about what happened in the world, even if every detail and every date and every location wasn't precise. But for an event like this, where the people on the stand were going to be grilled by David Irving's attorneys, it was important to only put on the stand those people, historians, who could speak dispassionately and with a total command of all of the precise, specific historical facts and all of the historical information. And so even at an event as loaded as the Irving Lipstadt trial, where so many survivors wanted to testify, put me on the stand. Let me tell the world what I experienced. The attorneys who have to figure out not how to, in the short term, give the survivors the greatest sense of being able to express themselves, but in the longer term, give them the greatest vindication by winning the case, decide not to put any of them on the stand. Because in this particular context, as true as their memory was, it was not going to stand up to the scrutiny of history, of the nitpicking of Irving's historians and attorneys, of the, well, he was his own attorney, but Irving's own command of the historical record and what exactly happened, when, and can you prove it? One more example of this. I was once at a Yom HaShoah commemoration. I work in a modern Orthodox co-ed high school in New York City called SAR High School. I was at a Yom HaShoah commemoration at SAR High School, and every year there's a different theme to the Yom HaShoah commemoration. And this year, the theme of the Yom HaShoah commemoration was individual testimonies or personal testimonies. And they put up on the screen the letter from the 93 Beis Yaakov girls who realize that they are being taken for sexual exploitation by Nazis and decide to end their own lives rather than succumb to that. And I saw that up on the screen and was very taken aback because, again, it is very well known that within, well, it's very well known within communities where that letter was circulating earlier, which probably means communities that are more highly populated by Beis Yaakov girls. That letter went around much sooner, and it was well known that that letter was a fiction. I don't know if it was written as a hoax or was written as fiction and then mistakenly adopted as fact. That letter is not a factual letter. In the modern Orthodox community, which I guess had less exposure to that letter, sometime in the mid 2000s or early 2010s, somebody thought that this was an accurate historical letter and put it up. And so I shared after the event with my school community that that was not, in fact, not again, that there isn't plenty of evidence of terrible atrocities being committed in the Holocaust, including the sexual exploitation of Jewish women. It is a different kind of myth that Jews told themselves in the early years after the Holocaust that the Nazis, because of their racial beliefs, did not rape or sexually exploit Jewish women. That's not true. We have a great deal of historical evidence it's not true. Whatever their racial beliefs were, they managed to set them aside to rape and sexually exploit Jewish women. That might have been a story that gave people some measure of comfort at some point. We know that's not true. But this narrative of the 93 Beis Yaakov girls who found that they were being sent for those purposes and chose to martyr themselves rather than succumb might be a very powerful story. In fact, it connects to a story that the Midrash tells us about boatloads of young men and young women after the destruction of the temple being taken away for the same purposes and choosing to die by suicide, jumping off the ship into the ocean rather than succumbing to that. And so it connects even to that story. It connects very powerfully to Jewish memory. But in this case, this is not history at all. And so I ask that we not share. And so I think I'm presenting that there's really a pretty knotted up conundrum. That on the one hand, I do not want to say things that are absolutely simply historically inaccurate, even if they resonate a great deal with history. And on the other hand, things that resonate with our history and that speak to a set of experiences we have had and a broader truth about the experiences, but are not pinned down in every detail or could not be pinned down in every detail. Or maybe the Jews of this community didn't martyr themselves rather than convert. They were simply all slaughtered. And saying that they martyred themselves rather than convert gives them some agency or voice or control over their own deaths rather than just making them victims. And so it does something for us to tell the story in that particular way. And we can tell the kina that way without feeling like we are saying a prayer that is a falsehood. And at the same time, I want to acknowledge that it is not only memory that does this work of holding on to stories and giving meaning. And I want to discuss one example here, not from prayers, because it's a story about history, not memory, but of a story about a history that gives enormous meaning and something that I found profoundly moving from the first time I read it and any time I read it. And I was talking about this book, just this morning to my children, and one of my children said something to me about not wanting to read this book or not being able to read this book. And I was really taken aback. I said, really? Because I think it's an incredible book. And my son said to me, no, it's not that I don't think it's an incredible book. I can't get past one chapter of it. I cannot read this book. And that is Who Will Write Our History by Saul Kassow. It is a history of the Einig Shabbos archive, which was amassed by a historian named Emanuel Ringelblum in the Warsaw Ghetto. If you have not read the book, I cannot recommend it strongly enough. Who Will Write Our History by Saul Kassow. The Einik Shabbos archive was assembled by historians and writers, intellectuals, all kinds of, and just all kinds of people in the Warsaw Ghetto who felt like we want people to know who we are. We want people to know that we live. We want people to know that we existed, and we want people to know that our lives had meaning before they were ended. And so they collected everything, everything of life in the Warsaw Ghetto. They collected diaries and letters and personal narratives, and they collected candy wrappers and playbills from Yiddish plays, and they collected newspapers, and they collected writings, and they collected they did it. Amanda Ringelblum did a massive academic study of life in the ghetto. At every level and in every dimension, they said, history here. The precise primary source specifics of who this group of people were and how we lived. Not an ennobled story of martyrdom, not anything else, but the most granular details of who we are and how we spent our days and what we did and how we came and went and what we experienced. And that is a way of ensuring that our memory lives, that we live, that somebody remembers the precise, specific human details of who we are. They later made a memory out of, a movie out of it. Probably about a decade later. The movie came out in 2018. I'm guessing the book came out about a decade before that. The movie is a good Tisha B'Av movie to watch. My kids watched it on Tisha B'Av. I'm not sure it's great filmmaking otherwise, but the book is just a remarkable book and incredibly worth reading. Although you, like my son, may find you can't get through a chapter of it without just being just so devastated exactly by the accumulation of who these people were. And he found, Ringelblum himself was not an observant Jew, but he connected himself into the observing communities, into the Gerach Hasidic community in the Warsaw Ghetto. He wanted to collect everything about everybody. And then they packed it into some metal milk cartons and some metal rectangular boxes with lids, and they buried them underneath the Warsaw Ghetto. Of course, after the Warsaw Ghetto uprising in 1943 and then the broader Warsaw uprising in 1944, the entire ghetto, much of Warsaw, was leveled by the Nazis into total rubble. And so that after the war, when people came back to find, to retrieve the Einik Shabbos archive, there were no landmarks you could operate on to see where anything was because the entire ghetto was completely destroyed. They retrieved some of the Einik Shabbos archive, but not all of it. Some of it is missing to this day. And of the archive that they retrieved, unsurprisingly, the milk cans were watertight because they were milk cans. And so the documents in the milk cans were better preserved. The rectangular metal boxes with lids were more vulnerable. And so the things in those boxes ended up more waterlogged and water damaged, and not all of them were visible or accessible. And because the Einik Shabbos archive was retrieved in post-war Poland, it ended up behind the Iron Curtain. And so historians didn't have a great deal of access to it for a long time, which is why Ringelblum's book, I'm sorry, which is why Kassow's book, first comes out in, I'm going to say about 2008, but I might be wrong about that year, give take. First comes out in the first decade of the 21st century after the Iron Curtain has fallen and historians can spend much more time examining those source materials. But that is an example I just want to point out of history actually being used in the service of creating a different kind of memory, a memory that says, don't subsume us into your broader stories of Akedat Yitzchak or the 10 brothers selling Yosef. Instead, recognize the incredible specificity of who we are and how we lived and why it mattered that we died. But I promised you in the title, thinking about Jewish history as we live it, and I would like to do that. I just want to say for a moment that there's all kinds of things coming in the chat. I found from experience that trying to pay attention to the chat while I'm speaking is very train of thought derailing, and so I'm not looking at any of it. When we're ready for questions, I will look at what is in the chat. Because here's where we find ourselves right now, and it is obviously deeply painful, as everything about right now is deeply painful. But it also, I think, needs some real thinking through. We are living through very painful Jewish history. One of the ways we make meaning out of this Jewish history is to connect it to Jewish memory. The same way that the people who wrote Crusader narratives connect them to the story of Akedat Yitzchak. The same way that whoever it was who wrote the keynote about the Asara who gave Malchut connected them to the stories of the 10 Shvatim, the 10 brothers selling their brother Yosef. We see people all around us making meaning of the events of October 7th and after by connecting them to Jewish memory and Jewish stories. And that can be very powerful. But at the same time, we collectively, the Jewish people, are being faced with the reality that the people who wrote the Crusader narratives were not faced with. They didn't have to think about what are the implications for the way I tell this story, for how I relate to the Christians among whom I live. They had no power over the Christians among whom they lived. They had no ability to do anything to the Christians among whom they lived. They were living at the more or less sufferance, greater or lesser sufferance, depending on the time of the Christians of who they lived. And they could tell whatever stories about the Christians they want, as long as they could get away with them, the censors didn't censor them. Today, the stories that we tell about the events of October 7th, the way we connect it to Jewish memory, not only helps us make meaning of the day, think about it theologically, help us tell ourselves a story about it, it also has implications for what the Jewish people or the state of, let's not say the Jewish people, let's say the state of Israel, but that's a pretty significant chunk of the Jewish people, what the state of Israel does next. And so, to pick a very specific example, if I choose to make sense of the events of October 7th by connecting them to the story of Amalek, which is a story that we Jewish people carry around with us all the time. We're more comfortable with it. We're less comfortable with it. We carry it around with us all the time. We all go hear Parshat Zachor every year. It is a mitzvah to hear the commandment to eradicate the memory of Amalek every year. But it's a mitzvah in a hovering up here somewhere kind of mitzvah that I hear about it. Amalek doesn't exist. I'm never going to meet a person of Amalek. I'm never going to be asked to put this into practice. The extent of my observance of the mitzvah is that I remember them once a year. And then I say more mean things about Amalek on Purim, and we're all happy and we all go home. When I invoke that story and that historical memory of Amalek, which is very powerful and gives us a way of understanding those horrific events, not just in a why didn't the Israeli army do X or Y, but this is part of Jewish history and part of our story, and there is meaning here. That has very real world practical implications. And so that crossing over of history and memory has ramifications, has impacts that it didn't have when the Crusader narratives crossed over history and memory. The comment that people sometimes heard after October 7th, which was very controversial, and many of you are going to be very upset that I'm even bringing it up, but that history didn't start on October 7th, which meant we can't just look at this event by itself. We have to look at the entire historical context in which it happened. Whether you like that or not, I think that is actually a specific, it wasn't meant to be this way, but I actually think it functions as a specific call to history rather than memory. Don't say this is part of a millennia-old hatred that non-Jews have for Jews. Instead, look at the people who are saying that are calling for, look at the specifics of the circumstances in which this occurred and understand this in its specific circumstances. The challenge for us, I think, that is that as a Jewish people, having had this horrendous a tragedy befall us, it is right and proper that we should understand it as part of our Jewish story, that we should understand it as our Jewish memory. That is what we should do. There is a reason we are talking about this on Tisha B'Av. We'll also talk about it on October 7th, but there's a reason we are talking about it on Tisha B'Av. We have long since established that Tisha B'Av is a day for commemorating all of the tragedies that befell the Jewish people, because we see all of these tragedies as connected fundamentally to our state of being in exile. That means that we are connecting every tragedy that we talk about and the ones that we don't talk about to our Jewish memory. And that is what we have to do. But at the same time, and I am not offering you any solutions here in case you thought I was. I'm simply naming a challenge. At the same time, if we use that Jewish memory to talk about the events of today, they can drive, when we in fact have the ability to take, or again, the government of the state of Israel has the ability to take actions and make decisions as a polity on the basis of that memory, then I think we have to ask us where that memory is driving us. There is a lot of talk of revenge in our liturgy. There's a lot of talk of revenge in our liturgy. There's a lot of talk of revenge in our Tisha B'Av keynote. We say Al Naharut Bavel, one of the Psalms, Psalm 137, I'm pretty sure it is, before we say grace after meals during the week, right? And we end by saying we are asking God to wreak vengeance against Bavel, against the Babylonians who have done such horrible things to us. And we end off by saying, Ashrei she'yochez v'nipeis et olalayich el hasela. Fortunate is he who grabs your infants and smashes them against a rock. That's in Psalm. That's what we say before we say Birkat HaMazon. That works as memory. It works as saying terrible things were done to us, and I, in no position of power to do anything about it, use the words of the psalmist to express how strongly I feel, how anguished I feel. And more than that, given that I am in no position to do anything about it, I ask God to do it, right? We say, avenge before our eyes the vengeance of your servant's spilled blood. Or in this case, in Al Harut Babel, it's not really God. I just say, fortunate is the one who, I don't know who I'm calling on to do this. But at a time when there is a sovereign Jewish government that actually has the power to do these things, the way we invoke Jewish memory becomes much more complicated, much more fraught, much more potentially problematic. And so thinking about the ways we deploy and use Jewish memory, even as we must deploy and use Jewish memory, we are a people, Yerushalmi said, going all the way back, who thinks about our past and what the meaning of our past is for us and the charge that our past gives to us. And when something as horrific as the events of October 7th befalls us, of course we are going to and we must view it in the context of our entire national experience, national memory, what has befallen us as a people, who we are as a people, what God's story for us as a people is. And also, at a time when there is a sovereign Jewish polity that has the ability to take action and do things that the Jews did not, an ability the Jews did not have, not when they were singing those words of Psalms about their Babylonian captors, not when they were reciting Crusader narratives about their Christian oppressors, not at any of the other points in, not when they were fasting in Sivan. Side note, there's no memory of Gzeirot Tach and Tat, the Khmelnytsky massacres of 1648 and 1649 in Tisha B'Av. The Khmelnytsky massacres, I'm reasonably certain this is historically accurate, were the worst large-scale murder of the Jewish people between the destruction of the Second Temple and the Holocaust. That's a pretty long stretch of time in which to be the worst massacres of the Jewish people. Again, I'm reasonably certain that the death toll of the Khmelnytsky massacres, I haven't checked this in a long time, but the last time I checked it was in the six figures. There's no mention of the Khmelnytsky massacres in Tisha B'Av, and the reason for this is because the Jews of Eastern Europe had a separate fast day commemorating the Khmelnytsky massacres. It was in the month of Sivan. Right, the same month that Shavuot falls out, and the same month that many of these Crusader narratives talk about. Because in the spring, okay, it's not all that different, by the way, from campus protests and encampments. In the spring, the weather gets warm, and people can go outside, and you can go outside for all kinds of things, right? In the winter, it's freezing cold in Ukraine. You're not going out to find Jews en masse and slaughter them. So the Khmelnytsky massacre was the day for commemorating the Khmelnytsky massacres was in Sivan. There was a fast day. There were a whole separate set of prayers that were recited then. But with the eradication of Jewish communities of Eastern Europe in the Holocaust, that day and its attendant practices were lost. And whatever the prayers were that were recited never made their way into the Tisha B'Av liturgy. And so on Tisha B'Av, we commemorate various other, and the Crusades, if you look at the numbers, as horrific as they were and as large as they loom in Jewish memory, the Crusades killed a very small number of Jews. Now, the whole all the Jews in the world was a very small number of Jews. It was a very significant percentage of the Jews in Ashkenaz, in the Rhineland. I'm not here to crusade, minimize, or justify or exculpate the Crusaders. But the Khmelnytsky massacres killed a vastly much larger number of Jews than did the Crusades, and yet there is no memory of them in our Tisha B'Av keynote recitation. And if anyone were asking me, which they're not, our keynote don't have to be longer. We could leave out some of the Tzions. I'm a Tzion dispenser myself. And bring back one of those prayers remembering the Khmelnytsky massacres, which we've completely lost. To go back to what I was saying before I interrupted myself, which I do a great deal. My students find that very funny. And then I will conclude here so I can take some questions. I have 12 minutes before I have to run down the hill. What I was in the middle of saying when I interrupted myself was that at a time when there is a sovereign Jewish polity that actually has the ability to wield enormous military force, when there is a Jewish army, then the ways in which we deploy our memory, our Jewish memory, require a great deal of thinking about and a great deal of care. Yes, we have to deploy them. They are profoundly meaningful. They are important for us as a people. It is not going to be, as I said, dry academic history that motivates our future generations to want to stay part of this story. And yet, at the same time, I think we have to be very, very careful about not bringing in parts of Jewish memory that take what we're meant to be, calls for divine vengeance, or calls for a vengeance that we never expected to be able to execute so we could call for whatever we wanted, and use them as a mission statement, or deploy them as a mission statement, or even just pass them on to our children in a way that shapes our children's minds to think this should be a mission statement, calling for what is, after all, the literal meaning of those words. I'm not at all denying that. So let's look now quickly through the
I'm sorry.
chat.
Take questions in a sec. Yeah, just let I'll let it go through the chat box. And I don't know if there's
Okay, I've been asked to repeat the reference to the book about history and memory. Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi wrote a book called Zachor, Jewish History and Jewish Memory. And although I didn't cite it particularly, if you're interested, that it's a very skinny little book. There's another skinny little book that's about a generation, 40 years later, called Shuva, The Future of the Jewish Past by Yehuda Kurtzer, who's my very once in a while, I mean, not once in a while, but my very part-time boss when I work at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America when I'm not working at SAR, in which he, as a Jewish historian, revisits Yerushalmi's argument from a different perspective 40 years later, saying that history alone is not going to save us, but how can we come up with a version of memory that makes sense to modern people who, after all, don't just want to tell mythical stories that have no connection to history. And so, again, that's The Horror, Jewish History and Jewish Memory by Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, and Shuva, The Future of the Jewish Past by Yehuda Kurtzer. Oh, great. I was expecting the Divrei Hayyamim question. I got the Divrei Hayyamim question. Terrific. So there's two books in the Bible that tell us all about the history of the kings. There's Malachim, Book of Kings, which is the one that says, ruled for 55 years, did bad in the eyes of God, and then goes on to talk about who did bad in the eyes of God. There's a much later book all the way in the Tanakh called Chronicles, Divrei Hayyamim, and Chronicles gives you much more of the stuff that I said Divrei Hayyamim doesn't give you, the kind of political ins and outs and everything else. So Shelley asked the great question of, we don't need to know more than Menashe did wrong in God's eyes. Why did Divrei Hayyamim tell us all of that? And Shelley, it's a great question. Totally expecting it, hoping to finesse it, to be perfectly honest, but you asked it. I would say that the relative prominence, the amount of time that we spend learning Malachim and Divrei Hayyamim, the citations we give Divrei Hayyamim is like, well, let's look at this just to contrast or back up what it says in Malachim. Malachim is part of the Nevi'im. It's the work that's studied much more. Divrei Hayyamim and Ketuvim is studied much less. And so I think that while it does perhaps soften his point, it doesn't completely blunt his point that what we seem to be primarily interested in is the stories in Malachim, which is a very specific kind of narrative about the king. And there are some references to things at the time I was saying them, so I don't know what they mean. Okay, so then somebody raises the question of, is there a distinction between poetry or stories during davening and actual tefillot? So trying to make the argument that Nachem is different than the keynote. Again, I'm not from a community that changes the text of Nachem. I've never changed the text of Nachem. I'm not changing the text of Nachem. It might, in fact, be that for those people who change the text of Nachem, that's how they explain changing the text of Nachem, but still saying the kina about the Asar HaRikei Malchut that we know is not historically accurate. I think there is a broader I think there is an underlying substrate here, which is that even the community that said we need our tefillah to be true, someone from that community said to me this year, we're all saying the original text of Nachem. That when we feel the powerful memory truth of Nachem, even if it is still not in historical truth of Nachem, that there are more people who are willing to say it. Oh, so then someone asks me about the survivors being put on the trial in the Demjanjuk trial, and was this a mistake? We're not really here to talk about the Demjanjuk trial, but the trial of John Demjanjuk was a, I think we could all agree, a very big mess. And it was a very big mess. I think that's very right. I do not think that it is denying the Holocaust or denying survivors' memory to say that when a survivor points to somebody that they last saw 40, 50, 60 years ago and says, I am sure that this is the person I saw his face every night in my nightmares, that is not, in fact, an accurate way to identify a person. We have a ton of evidence that eyewitness testimony isn't accurate in general in the American criminal legal system. Different discussion. When it's somebody you last saw 40 years ago, and you are 40 years older and they are 40 or 50 or 60 years ago. The Demjanjuk trial, some of you might know, went back and forth and back and forth. Conviction, reversing the conviction, conviction again, deportation. Because relying on somebody saying, I recognize this man's face, I know him from 50 years ago, might not in fact be the best way to establish somebody's culpability. At Yad Vashem, I heard two guys on the same day tell the same story differently. It was unsettling. Both claim the historicity of the story they told. Right. The part of what you're saying that is interesting to me is claiming historicity. That's the part where Yaf Eliach has this beautiful book, Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust, right? Which she's very clear are tales. They're not meant to be historical narratives of what happened. They're deep reflections of Jewish experience and Jewish memory and how we think about things. And there are so many stories like that. when you start asserting that something is historically accurate, I do think you have to be able to back it up. Elul Hashem's guide should probably be telling things that are historically accurate. I'm not sure what is the book title? Who will write our history? History of the Oinig Shabbos Archive. And historians call it the Oinig Shabbos Archive because the people who made it called it Oinig Shabbos. They called it Oneg Shabbat. That's not what they called it. They called it the Oinig Shabbos Archive. It's a long book. Unlike the other two that I cited to you, it's a long book. I don't have enough. Again, I'm an historian by training. So maybe that idea that history can be a powerful way of honoring the victims of the Holocaust and all their individuality and specificity speaks to me particularly. But then my 22-year-old son told me he can't read more than a chapter of it without breaking down. So maybe it's not just me. Okay, so Shelley now asks another good question, which is what about our practice of always looking for what we did wrong as the reason behind historical events? The Shoah was not caused by our sins, by the Nazis. Shelley, I'm sorry, but that's what I'm speaking about at 4 o'clock in shul. At 4 o'clock in shul, I'm speaking about theodicy in real time. I can't really give you that whole hour long talk right now, but I will say my very short version of the answer to your question is, I'm just going to say this very bluntly. I don't think it's really true that we don't accept a theodicy of blame. We don't accept the theodicy of blame about events we can remember. We find it horrifically offensive when somebody says the Holocaust happened for this sin or that sin. We all totally accept and say all the time the Second Temple was destroyed for the sin of baseless hatred. What do you mean? Hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered. Yeah. You're willing to say that about that? Right, because I don't remember it. I didn't see it. So I don't really think it's true that we do or do not accept that theodicy. I think that the truth is that explanation for evil in the world, that it's because of our sins. I think we accept it readily all the time about events we can't remember, and we recoil from it in horror about events that we can remember.
Dr. Ripke, if I may, on that last issue, I'll say, I know you have to leave. I don't believe that the rabbis mean that the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. I actually spoke about it in the podcast I gave. I spoke about it this morning. Can explanation? I don't believe that's true. There are at least 12 different reasons in the Babylonian Talmud and at least an additional one in the Jerusalem Talmud why the temple was destroyed. It means the temple, the rabbis have no, they're not prophets. It would be a chutzpah of the rabbis to say, because of Sinat Chinam, the temple was destroyed. What the rabbis are saying is that sort of, what can we learn from the fact the temple was destroyed? The temple was destroyed because of the Romans. There was a rebellion, whatever the historical geopolitical reasons are. That's why the temple was destroyed. The rabbis always look, what can we learn from this event? And every rabbi living in a different time, in a different place, had a different explanation. They got 20 different reasons. The Gemara in Shabbos lists off 7 different reasons in a row why the temple was destroyed.
I don't think that's a disproof of me. I think that's a further proof of me. They might have had 12 different ones, but they were very willing to give us sins that were the reason for our mass slaughter. The first person to come out now and say this sin was the reason for October 7th. I mean, I don't know. Maybe someone did already. I don't know. I think that anybody who did that would get obliterated, annihilated. Nobody wants to hear that about an event that we are suffering through right now. But we all accept it as an explanation. I want to just say finally that my good friend Rachel Weiss Luftglass, who turns out to be on this, who is a far bigger Tanakh scholar than I, says that the Abarbanel in his introduction to Divrei HaYamim does a great job comparing and contrasting Divrei HaYamim to Malachim and the agendas of each one's author. So if you want to know much more about the differences between Divrei HaYamim and Malachim than I said here, or frankly than I know, please follow Rachel Weiss Luftglass's advice and look at the Abarbanel's introduction to Divrei HaYamim. And to the person who asked if I'm related to Susie Cooper Press, I'm her daughter. That looks like we've exhausted all the questions in the chat. We probably have time for one person question before I have to run.
Bakasha, anybody?
Nobody. You can walk more slowly now. You don't have to fly. Thank you.
Here's the book. Here's the book. Who will write a history? I heard the author speak in Toronto a number of years ago. It is a fascinating book. It was published in 2007. So you're 1 year off.
Okay, wasn't so bad.
Thing, but yes, it's a book. It went on the Oinig Shabbos archives. I pulled out the Zohar book. You'll see it's much smaller. The Zohar book. You can read this in a couple hours.
Thank you.
So anyways.
And here's Amazon, if anybody wants to shoot.
Okay. That book I don't have, so I couldn't pull it up.
Also small.
Yes, okay. But okay, Rivka, always a pleasure, always something to think about, and thank you. And I know we're off to Mount Sinai, so we don't want you to be late. Okay, so all the best.
Freedom,
okay,
I'll see you in a few minutes.
Thank you so much.